Welcome back, Michael.
Thank you. It's good to be here.
From the Mackinac Center. Nice to have you. We're going to talk briefly here and probably about several subjects, but cigarette smuggling.
Cigarette smuggling.
Is a big thing.
Huge,
it's
actually.
Growing, too.
And it will continue to grow with the recent passage of a cigarette tax hike here in Michigan.
Increase in
This is something that really kind of takes you off guard when we even bring this up. Because, mm-hmm. first of all, you know, we've been hearing that the state was going to maybe boost it 50 cents, the tax on cigarettes, from 75 cents to a dollar and a quarter, I believe. I think that went through. I'm not sure.
It's waiting the governor's signature now.
Okay. And, you know, some people might think, well, hey, that's great. It'll cause people not to smoke, perhaps. Of course, my wife and I, we've got kind of the opinion saying, well, instead of doing that, if it's really that bad, why don't you just say it's illegal, you know, and they don't want to do that. And you know, it's a tough decision either way, but you've got a whole different take on it.
I do. A
whole different take.
Ironically, government likes the revenue too much to make cigarettes illegal, and there's still a popular enough entity with the American public and with the public worldwide, mm-hmm. that politicians aren't ready to make it illegal. We have found, however, that smuggling exists between the states with cigarettes themselves, a legal product, because of the price differential. For instance, right. The price differential is in large part due to the cigarette taxes that states impose on them.
Right.
North Carolina, they impose 5 cents per pack. In Michigan, up until this August, we impose a 75 cents per pack tax. And that difference attracts smugglers who will buy van loads of cigarettes in North Carolina, ship them to Michigan, sell them illegally, and pocket the rest. We've profiled an individual who was just convicted of this crime. His name is Mohammed Hamoud, who was making about $10,000 a trip. That's actually small change. Last September, a truckload of cigarettes was stopped in Lons, Michigan, and they were carrying $115,000 worth of contraband cigarettes.
Mm.
Cigarettes purchased in North Carolina and sold here.
So if a trip right now can net you $10,000, can you imagine once that price per pack goes up another 50 cents?
Dramatically. And, of course, in economics, we look at price as a signal. So when price goes up, that's a signal to produce more of any particular good. Well, this particular good happens to be legal cigarettes being sold illegally. And that profit motive is going to draw more people like Mr. Hamoud in, who then funneled that money towards the Hezbollah in this particular instance for terrorist activities.
Yeah, let's go with that connection.
Sure.
Hezbollah,
sure.
You know, we've heard of them. Al-Qaeda, we've heard of even more of recently.
And both of those two organizations are connected.
There's a connection, though. Yeah.
Absolutely. Well, this actually story we profiled in our Viewpoint commentary for July. Starts in July of 2000 when there is a raid on a house, and they were raiding it because of, I believe, terrorist activities. But there were
two years ago,
there were tons of cigarettes found there. What they discovered was that Mr. Hamoud was running cigarettes from North Carolina to Michigan and then using the money to help out the Hezbollah in Lebanon. Now, Hezbollah, of course, you remember from the 80s, they're responsible for the Marine barracks coming down and killing 242 U.S. servicemen, mm-hmm. and, of course, for giving Israel fits. And they, Mr. Hamoud has actually funneled such products to them as night vision goggles, cameras, scopes, surveying equipment, global positioning systems, mine and metal detection equipment, video equipment, advanced aircraft analysis and design software, laptop computers, stun guns, radios, mining, drilling, and blasting equipment, as well as radar, using money that he made running cigarettes to Michigan.
You know, some of these wouldn't be considered true weapons, perhaps, but they're all used in that line of work.
Ancillary fashion.
Yeah.
Yeah, and of course, the cash that they can funnel to the Hezbollah can be used for any purchase.
Oh, sure.
So they might not buy explosives here in the States, but they can buy them elsewhere, mm-hmm. in the illegal market with money raised from selling cigarettes illegally.
Now, it's my understanding that these Arabs who go to Carolina,
mm-hmm.
buy the cigarettes, they come back and sell them to Arabs running stores.
The two individuals that we profiled actually lived in North Carolina, and what they would do is come up to Detroit and sell them to Arab-owned stores in the southeastern community, in the convenience stores. And incidentally, they're not the only ones to do that. There's actually runners from here to the Indian Reservation in Mount Pleasant who simply buy the cigarettes tax-free on the reservation and drive them to their convenience stores in Southeast Michigan.
Oh. Boy.
So our government in the state of Michigan is maybe helping to perpetuate and even more so with a higher tax on cigarettes, more funding for our enemies.
They're facilitating illegal activity, first of all, even if that money isn't funneled toward people who hate us in the Hezbollah or overseas and that sort of thing. They're simply championing bad economic policy because people are very self-interested, especially when it comes to their economic self-interest, and are willing to make illegal purchases at stores or from people like this.
Is the purchase down in South Carolina or North Carolina, I guess we're talking about, is it legal there to purchase them?
Sure.
Because you're buying them at retail and you are paying that 5% tax, right?
Right, 5 cent tax, yeah.
It's 5 cent tax per pack. It's only illegal to be bringing them up here to resell.
If you cross the border in Michigan with more than X amount of cigarettes, I think it's 2 cartons or 3 cartons from another state, then you can be hit with a smuggling charge.
Okay.
And it's interesting, in 94, after the first cigarette tax passed that brought us up to 75 cents a pack from 25 cents a pack, sales on the border counties in Michigan dropped 98%.
Yeah.
And the sales in Ohio and Indiana, right over the border, increased by the same amount.
Remember when Michigan, over the years, I'm not trying to get off track, has relaxed their fireworks type laws. Mm-hmm. When I was a kid, and maybe you the same way, I mean, about the only thing you could have was the little sparklers.
Right.
And nowadays, it seems like we have other things. But do you remember driving over the border just into Ohio, and they would have these great big things, and signs getting up to it, fireworks, you know, and the first exit over a border going into a different state. A lot of times, they're selling items, trying to entice people from the neighboring state over.
And it works.
Same idea, really.
Yeah. And it works. You know, there's a network of fireworks lovers, the people who enjoy doing fireworks, and they talk to each other, and you can tell them where to get what you want to get.
But for your own private use, that's one thing.
Right.
That's just like Canadians coming over the border to fill up their tank with gasoline. It's sometimes worth it because of the tax difference on the gallon or liter of gasoline. But when it comes to the cigarette smuggling, we're talking about a big business.
And you might be interested to know that the Canadians cut their cigarette excise tax to eliminate smuggling, and it worked.
Wow.
Oh.
Hey, let's talk a little bit more about that. Michael Lefebvre from the Mackinac Center for Public Policy is our guest. We're talking about cigarette smuggling and cigarette taxes and how the two go together. It's 9:21. We'll check out the weather forecast next and be back with more conversation on WKNX. Michael, before the break, we were talking about Canada and some of the things they have recently done to try to stop the smuggling activity. Now, was that within the provinces or over between the U.S. and Canada?
I believe that it was a Canadian-wide edict. They had been considered a champion of health reform, and that's one of the reasons they were taxing cigarettes. They wanted to thwart smokers. But what they were doing was increasing the profits of smugglers who would come over to the States and get it and bring it over. So in order to combat that, they simply lowered the tax so there'd be a smaller differential between American states and Canadian provinces when it came to cigarette excise taxes.
Mm-hmm. So if people are going to smoke in Canada, they might as well buy them from Canada and support the Canadian government and the manufacturers and the growers.
And the revenue will come in will be maximized instead of minimized. They'll, you know, the governments always lose more in these excise tax hikes than they expect to lose from people changing their behavior, whether it's quitting smoking, smuggling, or going to an Indian reservation.
It sounds to me like whoever is behind this raise in taxes is not thinking this thing through. Because like you said, raising it is just, I guess they'll get more money, but they're going to encourage smuggling more.
Right. There's
To me, it doesn't make sense.
There's an inverse relationship between price and quantity demanded. When the price goes up, people will demand less. But there's an offsetting factor, and that is a signal goes out for more people to engage in smuggling because it's profitable.
Mm-hmm.
So that kind of washes over the benefits the state thinks it will enjoy in terms of increased revenue.
Necessity is the mother of invention, they say.
It is indeed.
Well, you find a market, you go after it. You know, it'd be nice if it were legal, but this is not legal. And the one part about it, I guess, James Damask.
Damask, yeah.
Damask wrote this viewpoint, and he starts out and he draws you into it because he talks about this national drug control policy campaign or whatever. We've seen the ads on TV. I have, and they show all these little clips of people saying, you know, I helped kill somebody and I helped do this and that. Explain that a little bit.
Sure, I'd be happy to. We actually opened the viewpoint with a story about these national drug control policy commercials that are trying to persuade people to give up using narcotics because they can kill someone, even if it's not directly.
The illegal drugs. We're not talking cigarettes at this point.
We're talking a controlled illegal substance, marijuana or cocaine, because a lot of street deaths, particularly in the poorest neighborhoods, occur because people are fighting over turf for their mm-hmm. drugs. So these commercials are meant to endear people to those who are victimized by crimes and people, especially the innocent victims, who get hurt because of the drug, the profit to be made in drug war.
Mm-hmm.
Well, there's an angle there that parallels with the smoking war, or war on smoking, and this continuous hikes in the excise tax being used to funnel money to people who would hurt us.
Well, yeah,
as a country.
In the commercial, and of course they're actors, they are actors in there, but they are saying, you know, because I bought drugs illegally, because I did this, and even though they say, well, I'm not hurting anybody but myself, the money they have used has maybe helped support others that have assassinated people or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
Same way with the state of Michigan then. Now we're not putting the burden perhaps so much on the people in Michigan as the state government, which supposedly is the people, but that's beside the point anymore, by saying, all right, state of Michigan, you raised the price on tax or per pack of cigarettes. You have now made it even more advantageous for someone to go out and smuggle the cigarettes from North Carolina, and you're helping now.
And not only because you've made it so profitable, it gets closer and closer to having the profits of an illegal narcotic. You draw in people who are willing to do more and more, mm-hmm. such as hurt and kill people, to obtain those profits. And Europe is telling, because they have higher cigarette taxes than we do, and they have a real violence problem because the profitability is approaching that of illegal narcotics. Just a few months ago in Italy, two police officers were killed by cigarette smugglers. And when they busted these cigarette smugglers, they found that they were very sophisticated and even had a Kevlar-lined car or utility vehicle that they drove around in because they expected to do firearms battle over cigarettes.
Wow. Yeah, so the state of Michigan now, though, is helping to funnel money to Osama bin Laden if he's still alive.
Perhaps.
I mean, you know, indirectly and everything like that, but that's the possibility.
Okay, we haven't passed this tax yet.
Well, it's been passed. It has not been signed into law.
It hasn't been signed into law.
Right.
Is there any chance that it might not be?
No. The governor championed this cigarette tax, and he made a deal with a lot of very powerful people in Lansing, which you have to do to get laws passed.
Mm-hmm.
I don't see him vetoing a bill that he had championed. Okay.
And even though he is not up for election, a lot of these people in the Senate and the House are. And even if they took the advice of the Mackinac Center for Public Policy and said, you know, maybe this is not really good in the long run, I wonder how many for political reasons, because a lot of times the opponent's just going to go on the air with an ad campaign and say, do you know they vetoed the tax hike on cigarettes? You know, so they're trying to ruin the health of you and your children and encourage them to smoke. I mean, they turn it all around, don't they?
Turn it around and... this was just part of a larger deal. In order to get the votes that he needed to pass this, he had to promise to suspend the earlier passed single business tax phase-out.
Yeah.
So they were going to eliminate it over 23 years. We've gotten 3 years into it, and now it's been suspended for at least two, because that's what the governor had to do to get the votes necessary to pass the cigarette tax hike. Mm. Now, suspending this SBT phase-out will save revenue, but it'll probably also kill jobs because the single business tax is a very, very damaging tax to the economy. Takes a lot out of it.
That was the whole reason for it a few years ago.
Precisely.
Yeah.
And so now we're suspending it to make this budget deal happen when it was unnecessary. You know, just 2 years ago, the legislature was surprised that they had a $600 million surplus at the end of the year. But rather than bank it, they went on a spending spree and bought things like a new polar bear exhibit for the Detroit Zoo and offered $1 million for this so-called air zoo in Kalamazoo, where it was just going to be like a Smithsonian Institute air show in a big hangar. And by the way, they got the money for that air zoo, but the air zoo never opened because they couldn't raise the rest of the money privately.
Hey, let's take another little break. It's 9:30 on the Bob Dyer
program. John MacArthur coming up. We are back with Mike Holm. Wrapping up the cigarette issue, anything that we haven't covered? We know the tax is going.
Yes, I would like to make a little prediction here today.
Yeah.
The state has estimated that this new tax hike will raise $242 million additional in fiscal year 2002 to 2003, which is October to October.
Mm-hmm.
I would like to say that that won't happen, and their estimates are more enthusiastic than they should be. We'll bring in a lot less due to the smuggling factor. And it'll cost us more thanks to the increase in police enforcement that will be necessary.
Yeah, so many factors that aren't considered here. I don't want the listeners to think that we're saying, you know, that cigarettes are great and go out and smoke them. We're just saying that maybe this tax is not the right way of going about reducing cigarette consumption or
reducing the budget deficit.
Yeah.
We could cut spending instead.
Yeah, and you guys are really looking at it from a monetary standpoint when you deal with these issues. We're not looking at, even though saving money is a conservative effort, you know, you're not looking at it from Republican, Democrat, that side of it. You're looking at it, how can we save money? What's fiscal responsibility in this respect?
We are economists, not politicians. We're not central planners.
Just want to kind of pass that along to the listeners.
Appreciate that.
Let's change the subject here. You sent us some facts with a headline, "If you build it, they won't come." What does that mean?
Well, this is an article that
has to do with a couple of chain stores, doesn't it?
This a particular grocery store. This comes from our latest edition of Michigan Privatization Report on the final page, and it's about a project that is being worked up in Kalamazoo to build a grocery store where there hasn't been one in years because it's a rough neighborhood. Crime, the streets are bad, the city services are poor in this area. Unfortunately, three private grocery stores have failed in the same area in the 60s, 70s, and 80s, Meyer's Thrifty Acre being one of them. I forget the names of the other two stores. And so, unfortunately, our government central planners, both in Kalamazoo and the state of Michigan, decided, well, then the taxpayers should fund a grocery store for this area. And the state of Michigan has offered a $1 million grant to a development agency, a public one, in Kalamazoo, and said, you raise the rest privately and build your grocery store. And as we've heard that...
And this is a one only?
Just one only, yes.
Not a chain?
It's not a chain, no. It would be one only. And the idea that they were developing in Kalamazoo was to build it, but then hire someone to run it, contract out for that. But apparently, we're hearing that they can't find anybody who's willing to do it, because three have failed in that neighborhood before. So if this gets built and they hire the city to run it or the development community to run it, we will have our very first Soviet-style grocery store since the collapse of the Soviet Union right here in Michigan.
Wow. It's not the company store like the old 16-tons. It's the government store.
It's the government store, and the shelves will probably look similar to the ones in the Soviet Union after a while.
Yeah.
But
if it ever gets built.
If it ever gets built. And
because the state says, oh, hey, we've got money, we'll send it to you. But trying to come up with $4 million locally?
Of private and do it privately. They want them to raise the other $4 million in some local fashion, and they've been trying to do this privately, but nobody's been willing to give them their own money, which suggests something, doesn't it?
Yeah. Well, a rich person may have the money and say, hey, this sounds great, and I'm just a nice person, and I'm going to give it to them.
Right.
That doesn't mean it's going to make it. But business people aren't going to put money into it because they are business people.
Hmm. Yeah, and you know what? As well, someone once said, if you won $1 million and you wanted to do something charitable, would you give it to a government agency? Would you give it to a government welfare department?
Mm-hmm.
Well, that's what the charitable individual in Kalamazoo has to consider. Do I want to give this to a government agency to help these people, or do I want to do this privately the way I raised my money?
Well, now, the picture, Michael, is the building where the store is. were located?
Previously, yeah.
Previously.
Three stories.
Now it's a church.
It's a functioning church, yeah, and it operates just fine. It serves the needs of the people.
Uh-huh.
But nearby that will be the grocery store if it ever gets built.
The new one. You know, recently, and this kind of comes to mind because we're talking basically a real inner city type grocery store serving the needs of the local people, not forcing them to go across town to buy groceries and things like that. And in some respect, that sounds like a good idea.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, business is supply and demand. And if someone like Meyer, who is a Michigan-based business, mm-hmm. can't get a store to go in Kalamazoo, what makes the state of Michigan think they can?
Precisely. I'm always stunned by the enthusiasm of central planners to think they know more about business than business people.
Yeah.
And they know more about what we call picking winners and losers in the marketplace than business people. When they bet on a particular horse, they're excluding all the other horses, all the other entrepreneurs. Mm-hmm. Well, how do they know that they've picked the right one? And, in fact, if we have 15 seconds, I'd like to give you a brief story about how difficult it is to pick winners and losers.
Take 25 seconds.
Okay, great. Yeah. How many ways can you arrange three items? Well, it's a factorial question. 3 × 2 × 1 = 6. How many ways can you arrange 10 items? 3.6 million. You see, it increases exponentially.
Mm-hmm.
20 items is all the seconds comprising 10 billion years. Now imagine 52, like 52 playing cards. You could shuffle a deck of cards and never have the same combination twice in all of card playing history, yet. Central planners in Lansing and other governments think that they can shuffle our economic deck mm-hmm. and it will come out in a way that is superior to than if we had just been left alone. No one has this type of perfect knowledge. Maybe God, but mm-hmm. Mere mortals do not. And unfortunately, these central planners think that they know what's best for the rest of us. Mm-hmm. We call this feeding sparrows through a horse. If you want to feed sparrows because they're pretty, do you feed them directly or do you run it through a horse first? Well,
okay. It took me a second, but go ahead.
Okay. Yeah. And a horse is the government because it gets... It's like sand in the gears, and you have them picking winners and losers,
right.
And the right sparrows aren't getting the right food.
Yeah. You know, recently I saw a program on TV. As a matter of fact, it was a cable channel over in Ontario. It took a little vacation. And just going through the channels, I didn't see the whole little segment, but I think, is it Magic Johnson? Is he the basketball player that's from Michigan or whatever?
Yes, sure is.
I'm pretty sure he was the guy. Anyhow, has a bunch of stores in urban areas.
Theaters.
Are you familiar with that?
Yes.
Oh, is it theaters?
Theaters, yes.
I thought I thought they were talking about maybe grocery stores and other type of businesses trying to, bring the business right into the inner city. And it sounded like he was doing very well at it.
He has said that his theaters are doing extraordinarily well, and I'm happy for him. Have the Magic Johnson name attached to it, and people just love being part of that Magic Johnson culture
mm-hmm.
And being part of his name and his winning attitude. And he's done well with his theaters, and good for him.
It sounds like he's a very driven man to work. He doesn't want to sit around. He is driven, wants to come out on top, and sounds like those that are affiliated with him will also do well, too.
Yeah, and he's a productive, contributing member of society.
Yeah, mm-hmm. that sounded great. But I thought perhaps he was talking more about grocery stores, and I thought he'd be a good one to get this store going over in Kalamazoo, if possible.
Well, his name carries a lot of weight.
Let's take another little break here. We'll check out the forecast again. It's 9:40 on the Bob Dyer Program. Michael Lefebvre is our guest from the Mackinac Center for Public Policy.
Michael, going to your publication viewpoint,
mm-hmm.
You have something about law prevents electronic pricing. Would you explain that to us?
Sure. In the 1970s, Michigan legislature passed the Item Pricing Act, which mandated that grocers stamp every single item in their store with the price.
Okay.
This is heralded as a real consumer protection item mm-hmm. because that way people wouldn't bring their can or whatever they were buying to the checkout. And have a different price once they arrived. Yeah. And they thought that this is a way to prove what the price on it said.
Yeah.
Well, naturally, this takes thousands of man hours every month for grocery stores if they want to change a price. In fact, if they want to change a price, they've calculated most grocery stores have to wait till the price changes 4 cents before it is worth their while to send someone out to change prices on a bunch of cans.
Oh, boy.
Well, technology has sort of come and passed us by here in Michigan because we have the opportunity to put something called electric pricing units on the shelves. And a little readable electronic dial will be placed in front of every product in grocery stores if the Item Pricing Act is repealed, that can be changed from the back room with a radio signal. So you don't have to wait till the price changes 4 cents to send somebody out, and then you don't even have to send anyone out. You can just change it from the back room.
So you don't individually price the cans or the boxes.
Precisely.
Just a shelf unit, and it would be a LED-type display or something like that.
Yes, and a radio signal from the back room would change the price. You just have someone at a computer in the back room say, I want the price of canned carrots to go from 79 cents a can to 82, and they just type that in and hit enter, and it changes.
So what we're saying here is, in Michigan, you can't do this.
Can't do that currently, but there's a law in the legislature that's been introduced that will change that and allow grocery stores to take advantage of this cost savings, which is going to be passed down to the consumers because supermarkets are one of the most competitive industry in America.
Uh-huh.
1% profit margins, that will get passed along to consumers to draw more in.
Oh.
And they've got to keep the markup down because of the competitiveness.
Absolutely. And one grocery store found that they saved about 1,700 man hours a year from changing prices. That's a lot of savings.
In another state.
In another state, yeah. About 20 or so states allow for this.
Already.
Already, yeah. And it works very well. In fact, one of the first states to allow it, grocery stores said, look, we know this is new consumers, and we know you're nervous about it, that you might be hurt by it. If the price of this good at the register is different from the one we have electronically marked on the shelf, it's free. You get it.
Mm-hmm.
You get it for free. So what they did was they said, we're going to stand behind our guarantee that this is a better way to price goods. And consumers overwhelmingly support it.
Yeah, the problem I guess we could see is you're out there shopping, you put it in your cart, and it's 25 cents a can. By the time you get up to the register, it's now 27 cents.
Yeah.
But it seems like an easy way to go about that would be, say, we're only going to change these prices at midnight or something, too. You know what I mean? Where you don't have somebody in the process. They picked it up. It's in their cart, but not through the register yet.
That is the mechanism that is being used in 24-hour stores.
Okay.
Stores that are closed at night, they simply close it after. They simply change it after hours.
So you could actually program it in as the prices change throughout the day, perhaps.
Right.
I would imagine that the technology is there.
Yes.
And tell it to take effect at midnight.
Right. Or 2 hours down the road so that when somebody, it's less likely that there'll be a wrong price. And interestingly, if they have a product that's flying off the shelves that they didn't expect to fly off the shelves, they can raise the price to regulate demand.
Yeah.
So if you have bottled water that for some reason is just flying off the shelves, you raise it 10 cents a bottle, and that reduces the demand for it so that you can have a nice steady outflow and you don't end up with empty shelves before your next shipment comes in, and you can make more profit.
Well, the other thing, too, I'm sure consumers would not disagree at all if they lowered the price during the course of a day on a product while they've got it in their cart, and it was 25 cents, and now it's 20 cents by the time you get to the checkout.
No, they wouldn't complain at all, and, of course, if that's the grocery store's mistake in other states, what we've seen is they said, well, then you get it for the lowest price.
Yeah.
The lower price.
The consumer comes out ahead.
Almost universally, yeah. I mean, it's built-in private protections for the consumer to benefit greater, enjoy the benefits of this.
Well, according to the article where the electronic pricing is available in a survey, the customers approve.
Universally. They enjoy it very much, yes.
Over two-thirds.
Yes, there's a lot of people who just have trouble letting go of that old stamp on the can simply because it's customary. It's something you've gotten used to in your youth and
I can get by with not having the individual product labeled if it is on the shelf, visible, and tells me what product I'm getting. But if I'm looking at Kellogg's Frosted Flakes cereal, and they've got 12-ounce and 14-ounce and 20-ounce or whatever else boxes they are, sometimes it is difficult looking at the little stickers they've got on these shelves, trying to figure out, which one pertains to the box I'm buying. You know what I mean?
That's a very good point.
And it seems like with this electronic display, it would maybe be even easier to show that.
Grocery stores would go out of their way to ensure that price was lined up with the right box because it's their bread and butter. And those electronic pricing units are coming down in cost as well. So they're going to proliferate the more states accept them. I think they started out, they were $12 a unit. Now they're $5.50 a unit. So it's getting less expensive for the grocery stores to install them. So where states allow it, you're going to see this explosion in
And the more that allowed, of course, the price keeps coming down with technology.
Yeah, because it's profitable for these companies to make it. They plow it back into the business, and it gets cheaper. It's a basic microeconomic theory.
Yeah.
That's interesting.
And basically, the only thing holding Michigan back yet is an antiquated law.
The Item Pricing Act of the 1970s, But that could go the way
about
of...
About 1976.
76, okay.
Yeah.
And that could go the way of the dinosaurs, and we hope it does because this would be good for the consumers.
Do you guys find many laws like that?
Yes, in fact, we've actually held a contest. We call it the Outrageous Law Contest. Not only ones that are antiquated, but ones that are just silly. One of my favorites, like, for instance, there's a law in the book. It's a felony to incite Indians to riot. But it's not a felony to incite anybody else into a riot.
Okay.
It's kind of insulting to Indians. I mean, it's paternal, isn't it?
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And so that's been on the book. Oh, no, my favorite one is if you don't belong to a particular group, you are not allowed to have a sticker on your car for that group. So if you're not a member of the Grateful Dead, you can be fined if you have a Grateful Dead sticker on your car. Or a Tiger Stadium or a Detroit Tigers ticket. You could get... You could get a ticket for having a Detroit Tigers bumper sticker because you're not a member of the organization. Yeah, we have a state law that backs it up. The police don't enforce it real well.